And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is absolutely devoted to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And as I always say on this podcast, if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. It helps a lot. Today I want to talk about a subject that I have been reading about in mass. I mean, everywhere I see this subject coming up. And fortunately, my son David brought me a book not long ago that deals specifically, emphatically, cogently with the issue that is the subject of today's podcast. The book is titled Unnatural Death. It's subtitled Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing. It's written by Richard Weikart, who is no stranger to the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. He is a professor of history at California State University. He is an author. He's written all kinds of really important books. I think of the book From Darwin to Hitler, or the book The Death of Humanity, another Darwinian racism. His doctoral dissertation was on socialist Darwinism. And by the way, that book earned the biennial prize of the Forum for History of Human Sciences as the best dissertation in that field. That's quite a commendation. He has contributed to the Christian Research Journal, and he is a brilliant writer. He has the capacity to take the complex, make it simple, digestible, so you can translate that information to your children, to the people within your sphere of influence. His latest book, the book we're going to be talking about again today, is called Unnatural Death, and it is available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can check it out on the web at equip.org, or you can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, available to anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. It is an absolute honor and pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Weikart.
It's wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah. So what caused you to put pen to paper and start writing this book?
Well, actually, I'd been involved in research on this issue for quite some time. My book, From Darwin to Hitler, that you mentioned, that came out in 2004, broached this subject as well, dealing with the German situation. The way I got actually into it in that case was kind of a roundabout way, too, because when I was looking at the impacts of Darwinism on culture and intellectual life in Germany in the late 19th century, I noticed that there were some thinkers who were promoting euthanasia. Ernst Haeckel, the leading German Darwinist, for example, was one of the key figures who was promoting euthanasia, killing of people with disabilities, as well as assisted suicide in the late 19th, early 20th century. And then I happened to read a book by James Rachels, who was an American philosopher, and his book is called Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism. And in that book, he argues that because Darwinism, he believes, undermines the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic, therefore, he thinks that abortion, infanticide, euthanasia are all morally permissible. And that kind of caught my attention because I then realized there was a connection between these German ideas that I was reading about, these historical ideas, and the connections with Darwinian thinking, and then the euthanasia ideas that are around today. And if you look at not just James Rachels, who's not quite as well known as figures like Peter Singer is very close in his ideology as well, also believes that Darwinism undermined the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic and thus allows for euthanasia and infanticide and assisted suicide and such. And so that's how I got into this theme, actually, by looking at the history of Darwinism. And then as I expanded, I looked at other issues as well. In my book, Death of Humanity, that came out in 2016, I looked at a whole host of secular philosophies that have arisen since the Enlightenment period that have eroded the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic, thus bringing on a culture where we have acceptance of abortion and infanticide and euthanasia and such. And so this book sort of takes off from that.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. You used a lot of terminology, and sometimes I think we get confused by the words themselves. I think you mentioned assisted suicide, voluntary euthanasia, non-voluntary euthanasia, involuntary euthanasia, passive euthanasia. Help us with understanding so we have a basic grid by which we can continue on in this podcast, and people will understand what you're talking about when you talk about any one of those particular categories.
Yeah, great point. Okay. Euthanasia is where another person puts a person to death, and it can be for a variety of reasons, and it could be either voluntary, that is, the person asks for being killed, so that'd be physician-assisted killing or euthanasia. And by the way, that's legal in Canada and Netherlands and Belgium and such. That would be voluntary euthanasia. There is involuntary euthanasia, which is killing someone against their will. That would be like what the Nazis did early 1940s in killing people with disabilities. And that would be involuntary. There's also what's called non-voluntary. That's sort of between those two, where the person is in a coma or something where they can't give their consent for one reason or another, and the decision is made for them by someone else. Assisted suicide is where the person who wants to die has to actually themselves administer a fatal dose of medicine or whatever it is. Usually euthanasia is done by a physician with a injection. Assisted suicide usually is done through pills and is prescribed by in physician-assisted suicide, which is what usually is done. In the United States, we have that in 10 states. Oregon was the first state to legalize assisted suicide. Euthanasia, by the way, is not legal anywhere in the United States yet. Hopefully it will stay that way. And hopefully assisted suicide will be backed up too. But assisted suicide is legal in 10 states in the United States. But that's where the person has to themselves take the prescription. But it's prescribed by a doctor. A physician has to prescribe it for them. Now, there's actually a different situation in Switzerland too. Switzerland is kind of a different situation there because there are non-physicians that give euthanasia in Switzerland because of their legal system, there's no prohibition on assisted suicide or helping someone to die as long as you're not benefiting financially from it. And so Switzerland has become a place for what some people refer to as suicide tourism. So people sometimes will go from other parts of the world to Switzerland to be killed and put to death there.
A couple of terms, euthanasia. I mean, denotatively, it sounds like it has a good vibe.
Yeah, and actually the word euthanasia comes from the term good death. The EU is the Greek word that means good, and thanatos is the Greek word for death. So euthanasia actually originally meant good death. And in the early 19th century and earlier, the word euthanasia was used to essentially mean a physician helping a person manage pain, you know, be more comfortable in their dying. It didn't mean hastening their death, which is what it means today. In the late 19th century, that word took a shift in meaning to where it actually meant causing them to die, hastening their death, rather than just helping them to have comfort in their death.
So words and phrases are not univocal, they're equivocal. It really depends on the meaning that you pour into the word, and the word euthanasia has gone through transition over time.
Oh, sure. And you know, what happens is with these words get commandeered. And the reason they get commandeered is because people want to put a good spin on what they're doing. And so you get things, compassion and choices. That's one of the names of one of the euthanasia organizations that's promoting euthanasia. They want to see it as a compassionate thing. They want to sort of, basically hijack euthanasia and assisted suicide and claim that this is the compassionate, the loving thing to do for them. And so they want to portray it that way. So they try to use words that will give that kind of meaning. So in Canada, you know, what is euthanasia? They don't call it euthanasia. They call it medical assistance in dying, MAID.
Made,
That's
yeah.
what it's called in Canada. Yeah. So they take these terms to try to make it sound better than it really is. The word suicide, actually, interestingly, was a similar way. The word suicide was introduced in the 17th century. Before that time, the English word for what we call today suicide was self-murder. That was the term that was used for it, self-murder.
So, and note that you make very careful distinctions. One that actually I was not that aware of until I read your book, and that's why, parenthetically, I really advise everyone listening to this podcast to get this book. It is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. The thing that caught my attention is passive euthanasia. You make distinct, not all passive euthanasia is alike.
Yeah, it depends on the motive. That's the key issue. And you know, this is something that's interesting because a lot of euthanasia and assisted suicide advocates will claim that you know, passive euthanasia is the same thing. And so it doesn't, you know, since we allow people to die, you know, it's okay to turn off their ventilator or turn off the machine that's keeping them alive. And everyone, basically, all bioethicists, you know, even the staunchest, you know, most hardline Catholic or fundamentalist or whatever, you know, all bioethicists agree that turning off someone's ventilator if their situation is hopeless is not a violation of ethics and morality. And so a lot of euthanasia advocates will say, well, it's the same thing. You know, giving them an injection is basically the same thing because you're causing death either way. But the issue really comes down to intent. And here's why that's important. Because when a person is turning off a person's ventilator, for example, when they're at the end of their life and their body can't sustain their functions any longer, they're not doing it with, or at least, or it shouldn't be doing it with the purpose of wanting that person to die. I want that person to die. I'm wanting to end their life. And so I'm going to do that to end their life. No, they're turning off the ventilator just in the realization that it's fruitless and hopeless to keep their body functioning. And you lament their death, but you're not wanting it to end. And in fact, if when you turned off that ventilator, their body kept functioning, you would rejoice, you know, in it. You'd be glad that that happened. In fact, interestingly, that has actually happened in cases that have been taken to court where people's ventilators have been turned off. Sometimes their bodies keep functioning. They keep breathing on their own and they don't die right away. And that's a and the person who's turning off the ventilator, that to them would be a good outcome. But when you're giving someone euthanasia, the intent is to kill, or assisted suicide, same thing. The intent is to kill, and that intent is to bring it about as quickly as possible at that particular point. So the intent is completely the issue here, not the fact that your action is hastening their death. Yes, passive euthanasia, that is turning off someone's ventilator or life support system, does hasten their body to die. That does happen. But it's regrettable when it happens that way. But euthanasia and assisted suicide is something that's intended to bring about the death of that person.
Yeah, a lot to unpack here. At the beginning of the podcast, I was talking about how this is a seminal issue. It's not one of these tangential issues. We're off on a rabbit trail. We're talking about very substantive, critical issues that all people need to get a handle on. In the past
Yeah,
few
I've been surprised too. And when I've talked to people sometimes who aren't really aware of the issue very much, I've actually been surprised that people here in California who didn't know that assisted suicide was even legal in California, which it has been since 2016. And I'll talk to people around here and sometimes they'll say, oh, is that really legal here? They didn't even know that it was. And there are 10 states in the US where it is legal now.
Yeah, to that point, in the past few decades, assisted suicide and euthanasia were illegal almost everywhere in the world. So the operative question would be what, Richard Weikart, has changed?
Well, there's a number of things that have changed, but the biggest issue, I think, in my analysis is the secularization of our culture, where we have cast off ideas about there being any God or any supreme being above us or anything that gives significance or meaning to life. My analysis has been primarily in Europe and the United States. I haven't done a lot of intensive analysis of Asia or other parts of the world and stuff to see. But you're right, in other parts of the world too, assisted suicide and euthanasia have not been allowed. And I think part of the reason for that is because we do have this built within ourselves. We have this understanding that human life has value. Even if you're not a Christian, even if you're not a Jew, there still is this notion within us that human life has value. And interestingly, even secularists, a lot of times, despite their own philosophies, will sometimes embrace that kind of view. And in my book, Death of Humanity, I bring in some examples of that. So, for example, Bertrand Russell, who was an atheist philosopher, wrote a book called Why I Am Not a Christian, for example, very anti-Christian in his philosophy. And his philosophy taught that human life is meaningless, purposeless, but he didn't live that way. And there's a lot of, I bring in a lot of things in my book to show that he understood really deep down, he did understand that human life had value. That's why he was opposed to nuclear weapons, for example. He was out protesting against nuclear weapons and said, why did he care? Because he knew that human life had value. And so a lot of people, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, whatever, understand that human life has value. But unfortunately, as the secular mindset, when I say secular here, I'm talking about atheists and agnostics primarily, have gained greater and greater ascendancy in the academic world and in shaping our intellectual life and culture. There's become this notion that, such as Bertrand Russell's position, that human life doesn't have any meaning, purpose, value, significance. And so this then means, well, why not? Who cares? Why not allow them to do that? Let me give you an example of that that I bring in my book, A Natural Death. There's a Jewish secular thinker. He's not Jewish religiously, but Jewish by his descent, by his ancestry. Secular thinker named Yuval Noah Harari. He wrote a best-selling book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And in that book, he rejects the Declaration of Independence's claim that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he says, no, it's not true. And based on his own secular philosophy, which he claims is science, he claims this is scientific, his worldview is scientific. He says, this is what he says, I'll hear a quote for you. He says, according to the science of biology, people were not created, they have evolved. And they certainly did not evolve to be equal. Evolution is based on difference, not equality. So he totally gets rid of equality. And then he says, created equal should therefore be translated into evolved differently. And then he goes on to say, just as people were never created, neither, according to the science of biology, is there a creator who endows them with anything. There's only a blind evolutionary process devoid of any purpose, leading to the birth of individuals. Equally, there are no such thing as rights in biology. So he totally sweeps away this notion of a right to life, right to anything for matter, any kind of human rights there, and human equality. And the sanctity of life ethic that Christianity has taught and that has been embraced by many people worldwide, even aside from Christianity, teaches that humans are equal, that there's something about us that makes us valuable and equal, and that gives us rights. But a lot of the secular mindset is trying to push that aside and saying, no, there's nothing that makes human life particularly valuable. We're just the product of accidental processes that have happened through millions and billions of years. And so we don't have any purpose or meaning or significance beyond what we give ourselves to it. And so why not just end your life? It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, if you buy into the cult of progress, then I think what becomes preeminent in your mind is survival of the fittest and the struggle for existence.
Sure. And that's based on the Darwinian mindset that I just talked about here with Harari, too. Everything's just evolved and just a matter of chance. And so, and of course, they're dismissing any idea of any kind of afterlife. And so, you're not going to have to worry about any God or creator or, any responsibility to anything beyond yourself. And so, you're just going into nothingness, essentially, according to this kind of secular mindset.
Wonder if you can comment briefly on the significance in this whole conversation of the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, the Hippocratic Oath, interestingly, under the Greeks, it formulated in the several centuries BC by a Greek Hippocrates, but it wasn't a majority position among Greek physicians at the time. Greeks, many of them did practice physician-assisted suicide. Not all physicians embraced the Hippocratic Oath. In fact, most didn't. It was a minority position among the Greeks. It only became a majority position because of the influence of Christianity and really, in the early modern times is when it came to be used widely by physicians. And then by the 18th and 19th centuries, then it was pretty widespread. Of course, now it's on the decline because it not only forbade assisted suicide, which we're talking about today, but it also forbade abortion as well. And so the Hippocratic Oath was opposed to both of those and was really considered the norm in among physicians in the certainly in the 18th, 19th, and on into the early 20th century. And physicians, to be sure, have been fairly resistant to assisted suicide. There's a minority who have come on board with it. And in the countries where it's sort of most advanced, the Netherlands and Belgium, it does seem that a majority of physicians are on board. But on the whole, in Britain and in the United States, the medical associations have been negative toward euthanasia and assisted suicide for the most part. I mean, the American Medical Association, for example, is still opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide. Now, the California Medical Association, they went neutral on it when before 2016 it was voted on in California. So that's changing some, but the medical profession has actually been a little more resistant than certainly than a lot of other sort of secular thinkers in other fields.
You mentioned the ancient Greeks when you were talking about the Hippocratic Oath. Talk about the ancient Hebrews. What was their perspective on euthanasia?
Yeah, of course, they didn't have euthanasia as we're thinking of it today. But when we think about the issue of suicide, which relates to this, if you look at the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, which is, of course, the Hebrew Bible, suicide is almost always presented in a negative light. There's no out-and-out prescription of it, they're not forbidding it anywhere in Scripture except for, and thou shalt not kill, which many people would argue, and I agree with this as well, would apply to killing yourself. So I think the Ten Commandments, you shall not murder, does forbid killing
It
yourself. But
includes
if you look at the,
self-murder.
yeah, but it doesn't explicitly say that. So some people will say, think they got wiggle room there and everything. But if you look at the suicides that actually happened in the Old Testament, almost all of them were people who were morally evil. They're not good characters. They're not godly characters that are killing themselves, typically. One of the closest ones to maybe godliness, if you want to think of it, is Samson. But Samson, of course, was there because of his moral failures. That's why he was in the situation in the first place. When he so-called committed suicide, he wasn't doing it with the purpose of trying to kill himself. He was trying to avenge his enemies in doing it. So it wasn't just a matter of, oh, I'm just going to kill myself because I'm in pain here, or being, with my eyes plucked out or whatever. So that's not presented in a favorable light either. Again, Samson was there because of his moral failures. If you look at situations where people were in extreme distress, like Job, Job rebukes his wife when she suggests that he take the route of suicide. She says, curse God and die. And Job says, no, yeah, you know, we can't we receive if we receive good things from God, can't we also receive evil, at the same time? And so Job, of course, is commended in the New Testament also for as a man of patience and endurance. And that is the model that's given to the Jews in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament for Christians as well. The model for Christians is to endurance in the face of suffering and trying to find God's way. In that path of suffering, if it's chastisement, then to endure the chastisement. If it's for some other cause, like Job's cause, that you endure it. And God, obviously, in Job's case, God rewarded him in the end for enduring the suffering that he went through. One thing we never see in either the Old or New Testament is someone committing suicide because they were ill. That never happened. There's no case where that ever happened. You have in the New Testament, you have Judas committing suicide. But again, that's because of moral failure and because he betrayed Jesus. And obviously, Jesus lamented that it would have been better for him if he'd never been born because of his betrayal and then also his suicide as a result of it. So, and in the New Testament, although it doesn't out and out state, you know, don't kill yourself, it says your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, which is given to you by God, and says those who destroy the temple, God will judge. So that strongly implies, you know, that you're not to harm the body that God has given you, and thus makes clear that we're not to be committing suicide.
Yeah, and something that you point out, we've talked about the ancient Greeks and the Hebrews, but you also in your book talk about the Renaissance, sort of a rebaptism in the baptismal font of paganism. When the Renaissance takes place, attitudes towards suicide start to evolve as well.
Yeah, and that's, again, because they're going back to the word Renaissance, of course, means rebirth, and is a rebirth of ancient Greek and Roman attitudes and ideas, and people were reading a lot of the writings of those times, ideas about the Stoics. The Stoics were a philosophy that was very popular among the ancient Romans, and the Stoics were very pro-suicide. They very much thought that a person, once they reached the point where they no longer had any abilities to, you know, enjoy their life any longer, that they thought they should commit suicide. So the Renaissance was a rebirth of these Roman and Greek ideas, including the Stoics and others. And so they began discussing and writing about some of the suicides, in fact, of the ancient Romans, and really glorifying them. A lot of the people in the Renaissance were not yet willing, because of the influence of Christianity, they were not yet willing to come out and overtly say, you know, we're promoting, we're promoting suicide. But they did begin glorifying some of the ancient Romans who did commit suicide. And so in this way, you're right, the attitudes did begin to creep in at that time during the Renaissance period in the 15th, 16th centuries.
So someone might ask, what's the relevance of writing in your book about history? Could it be that if we don't know history, we're resigned to repeating history? So it's very important to understand what happened in the past so we can see exactly what's maybe taking place in our own context.
Sure. You know, I think, and it's good, I think, to be able to compare the ideas and see how they've changed over time as we're going through. And I think in looking at as I look at the Greco-Roman context and how they dealt with issues like assisted suicide and also infanticide, which I discuss some there too, because they were very much supportive of killing infants, especially with disabilities. But basically, parents had the option to kill their infant, you know, under any kind of circumstance. There was no penalties for that. They called it exposing them because they usually would just leave them out in the fields to either be devoured by a wild animal or to die of dehydration. But I think it's useful to compare the attitudes of the people in the ancient world, say there, with the Jewish and Christian attitudes of the time to see what the difference is and how the worldviews differed on the whole. And once again, being a Christian myself, you know, it strikes me that, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, even though they believe in gods, they believe in a lot of different things, they did not have the idea of the humans being created in the image of God, which the Christians had. And again, I do think that there are a lot of people in other cultures, and again, I haven't done extensive research in a lot of these other cultures, but I do think there's a lot of people in other cultures who do have that sense inside themselves, because God's given us a conscience. God's given every one of us a conscience, whether we're a Christian or not. Sometimes that conscience is misguided and dead and, you know, other kinds of things, but he's given us a conscience. And so I think a lot of people understand the value of human life, but Christianity has a reason to support the notion that human life has value. And that's why when I move into the 19th century and 20th and start showing the impact of secular thought and the way that they undermine the notion that human life has any value, this is then what leads us into this notion of that euthanasia and assisted suicide is permissible. Now, it's interesting that there are some people of liberal mindset who do reject euthanasia and assisted suicide, and sometimes they even try to back away from the religious dimension to it. But I think that's maybe misguided in some ways, because again, without the religious underpinnings, you know, if there is no God, if there is no morality, if, essentially, if there is no God, and then morality is just evolved, which is what a lot of Darwinists believe and such too, then why not, you know, just end your life? You know, what's the big deal about it? It's another event in the universe, just another chance event that took place, you know, with all the other chance events that are taking place in the universe. But Christianity shows us that there is something distinctive about humans that gives us value, that gives meaning and purpose to our lives, and that even gives meaning and purpose to suffering, which is one of the issues here too. Because again, most people think that I'm going through the suffering. Oh, it's horrible. You know, I can't go through the suffering. It's awful, and I just can't take it. And so I got to just end my life to get rid of the suffering. Which, by the way, if there is an afterlife, they may have more problems in front of them. They may have more suffering ahead of them anyway, but they don't believe that, of course. But Christianity gives a reason to endure suffering as well, and to shows a meaning even in suffering. Not that suffering is a good thing for a Christian. You know, death and suffering are the result of the fall, the result of evil. But God can use them for good purposes. And we see that again in the book of Job. We see that in a lot of other episodes. Well, Jesus' life himself, the most obvious one, you know, Jesus himself goes through suffering and death for our sakes.
Yes, he does. And, you know, as you're speaking, I can't help but think back to my own experience. I was born in the Netherlands in 1950. We immigrated in 1953. My father, a very committed Christian, towards the end of his life, had a fibrosing of the lungs, and it encroaches upon your ability to assimilate oxygen. And I still remember vividly, he was 74 years old, same age as I am right this minute. I was having this conversation when he was exactly the same age I was. He was 74, I'm 74 now. But anyway, back then, I think it was 1997, I watched him suffer. Richard, I watched the agony that he was going through just to get a gulp of air. And I remember asking him, Dad, wouldn't you just like to go home and be with the Lord? And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, no, every moment is precious. And so the very value that you talk about, the value in suffering, he was expressing to me with those words.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because a lot of people, when they get in those situations, again, it is, I want to be with the Lord. I want to, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. There is nothing wrong with wanting to be released from suffering. Of course, we want to be released from suffering. No one likes to suffer. But you're right. It's amazing how the attitudes have changed in our culture to where, you know, suffering is the absolute worst thing that can happen. Whereas we don't think about eternity. We don't think in reference to eternity these days. You know, you talk about your dad, my mother-in-law is living with us right now. She's 91 years old. She's got dementia, and I'm sort of her primary caretaker in a lot of ways. I get up at night with her and do different things with her and everything. And you think, well, what's the purpose? What's the meaning of her life, you know, in this time? And yet, you know, that's not our call. You know, that's not my decision to make, you know, when her life is going to end. I am called to be a servant. I'm called to, you know, be a blessing to those, and, you know, those people with disabilities. And what strikes me too, and, you know, in this whole conversation too, is that, you know, there's a lot of people who seek after assisted suicide and euthanasia, not just because of the suffering and pain. Sometimes, you know, that is an issue there, but a lot of times it's because of the loneliness. It's because of lack of relationship with other people. And some people who do this will actually say this forthrightly. Others times they don't necessarily say that, but it becomes clear from the data. I mean, Oregon keeps data on, they poll people who request assisted suicide, and they keep data on why they request assisted suicide. And a lot of times it doesn't have to do with pain. Less than 50% of the time does it have to do with pain. So this is not just an issue of pain. It's an issue that has to do with human relationships. It has an issue to do with love. You know, the people are lacking the love in their life that they need. And a lot of times, if they had that love, you know, they would be willing to go through that suffering. But without love and without connections and things, it just torments them even more, and it just drives them in ways that are unfortunate.
Yeah, when you talk about your mother-in-law, I can't help but think that you can't see necessarily the purpose of that suffering she's going through with dementia. My mother was also afflicted with dementia towards the end of her life. She died at 93. But in taking care of someone in that circumstance, you are changed. The caretaker, the caregiver is changed. My brother was the primary caregiver because he lived in the same locale, same state with my mother. And I can tell you, he was irrevocably changed for the better. He was a great person at any rate, but he was irrevocably changed for the better through that experience. It is life-altering and in a very positive sense. In the context of the discussion, at least somewhat in the context of the discussion, talk about utilitarianism.
Utilitarianism was a philosophy that came about in the 18th and 19th centuries and is still pretty prominent today. Peter Singer, whom I mentioned a little bit earlier, who has an endowed chair at Princeton University, he considers himself a utilitarian. The utilitarian philosophy was a philosophy that pleasure is the highest good. Essentially, it was going back, it was sort of recycling in some ways the Epicurean philosophy from the Greeks, which saw happiness or pleasure as being the highest good. And so usually they will justify morally whatever they think promotes the what they call the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That was a term that Jeremy Bentham, who's considered the founder of utilitarian philosophy. But again, it goes back to the it really he was influenced by Epicurean philosophy from the Greeks as well. Bentham said that what is morally permissible, was morally good is what promotes the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And by happiness, he meant pleasure, physical pleasure. So, and this is again, even among people that don't know the term utilitarianism and have never heard of utilitarian philosophy, it's becoming more and more widespread that just whatever causes pleasure is the good thing in life. And that's what we should be striving after, just going after our own pleasures and such. And you can see why that would be appealing to people. Of course, it is appealing because it caters to our fleshly natures, not because it really is satisfying to our spiritual hunger that we have in life. And so, unfortunately, the idea is that whatever causes pleasure is good, whatever causes pain is bad. And so, when people are have more pain than pleasure, then the utilitarian philosophy seems to suggest that it's probably better for them to kill themselves or to be gotten rid of in one way or another. In fact, just to give you one sense of how this got applied in terms of killing people, Jeremy Bentham argued, although he didn't argue this, by the way, publicly, this was in private manuscripts that Jeremy Bentham wrote back in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Jeremy Bentham claimed that committing infanticide was morally permissible. And the reason that he thought it was morally permissible was because he didn't believe there was any such thing as an inherent right to life or anything like that, because again, he thought that pleasure is the only thing that counts as being good. And so there's no right life or anything to any human being. There's no nothing beyond us. But what he said was that the reason that committing an infanticide is not is morally permissible is because the infant doesn't know it's going to get killed, so it doesn't suffer any pain or fear of pain. You just kill it instantly. As long as you're not causing it pain, he said. You don't torture it or whatever. But as long as you just kill it instantly, he thought that was permissible. And so he said the infant wouldn't feel any pain. The reason that Jeremy Bentham said that killing an adult is not morally permissible is because that would cause fear among people that they might be a victim of that. But the baby doesn't know it, so it's okay to kill a baby. But it's not okay to kill humans, not because there's any right to life, according to Bentham and the utilitarian idea, but because that would cause fear among people, and that fear would cause pain.
Interesting. We just went through an election cycle, and I've often said that the ballot box is necessary, but it's not sufficient because our culture is changed by so many other dynamics, including the entertainment industry. And I note in your book, you talk about a movie called The Black Stork. And in this movie, there's this theme that there are times when saving a life is a greater crime than taking a life. I mean, that's an incredible presupposition.
Yeah, and the movie was put out by a physician named Harry Heiselden, who had created a controversy by refusing treatment for an infant that was born that could have been saved. The life of that infant, it seems pretty clear, could have been saved, but the infant would have been disabled. And so he decided not to intervene medically. He convinced the parents, not to do anything. And so the infant died. It's called the Bollinger baby case. And so this movie was sort of a takeoff on that, sort of showing his justification for it and sort of putting forth his philosophy out to the world. It came out in the 19-teens, if I recall correctly, the Black Stork did. And it was to try to promote his ideas about how it's better sometimes not to intervene rather than to allow people who are sort of considered negative or, and by the way, this is a time, Harry Heiselden is a physician, and this is a time in the late 1890s and early 1900s when there were a lot of physicians and people who were pushing what was known as eugenics, which was a way to try to engineer humanity, create a higher humanity by getting rid of people with disabilities, trying to control reproduction in various ways. They tried to introduce compulsory sterilization. Not tried to, they did. They introduced compulsory sterilization in a lot of states in the United States, as well as Denmark and other countries. And the Nazis, of course, introduced that as well. And so Harry Heiselden, as well as a lot of others, viewed people with disabilities as being, they used sometimes the word unfit, the evolutionary word unfit. They also used some really derogatory terms, though, referring to them as being burdened and useless. And of course, the Nazis took the term or took the term over from other German thinkers, useless eaters. That was a term used by the Germans relating to them, but they considered them burdens and they had very negative views of people with disabilities. And so the idea was, let's try to get rid of them one way or another. Now, some people in the eugenics movement, to be sure, tried to just use controlling reproduction, like sterilization and the kinds of things. But other ones thought they should go ahead and just kill the people outright, kill people with disabilities, and that that was morally permissible. The Nazis, of course, were going to take that very in a more fanatical way than most people did. But in the United States, there were people in Britain, there were people promoting the same kind of idea too, that we should just kill people with disabilities to try to improve the human race.
Something else I noted in your book, which absolutely shocked me, I didn't know about this. So I was very surprised to read about Helen Keller's support of eugenics and euthanasia.
Yeah, I was very surprised to read that too, because of course she would have been a candidate for it at some stages of her life, according to the norms of some people at the time. But yeah, I was kind of shocked by that as well, that she thought that some people were less valuable than others. And even though she herself was a disability rights advocate in some ways, there were some people that she thought were better off dead.
You talk a lot about Darwinism in the book, and appropriately so. And you mentioned someone earlier, Ernst Haeckel. He, of course, is famous for the evolutionary cliche, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, that the emerging embryo goes through all of the evolutionary stages. So if you abort early on in the process, you're not aborting an infant, you're aborting a creature. So Darwinism had such an incredible impact, not only in the 19th and 20th century, but has and continues to have an incredible impact on this whole subject in the present.
Oh yeah, it certainly does. And of course, I read you earlier that quotation from Yuval Noah Harari's book, where he uses this essentially evolutionary thinking. Peter Singer uses the same kind of thinking as well. Peter Singer hasn't written an entire book on it like James Rachels has. I mentioned Rachels' book earlier, "Created from Animals: The Moral Implications of Darwinism," where he uses Darwinism very forthrightly to justify these things. But Singer has indicated at quite a number of different places that Darwinism does underpin his view that humans do not have any overarching purpose in life or anything beyond ourselves, tr nothing transcendent. There's no value to human life. In fact, I actually had an opportunity to debate Peter Singer on a radio show, Unbelievable. Where the debate was over, is human life intrinsically valuable? Of course, he took the negative view that human life is not intrinsically valuable. And part of that's based on his Darwinian worldview. And by the way, getting on that theme too, there actually are three scholars who have written sort of the best books about the euthanasia movement, the euthanasia and assisted suicide movement in the United States. That's Ian Daubigen. In Britain, that's Nick Kemp. And in Germany, that's Hans-Walter Schmuel. And all three of those make very clear that Darwinism was one of the very important underpinnings, ideological underpinnings of the euthanasia movement in the 19th and on into the 20th century.
It's so interesting when you, maybe macabre, when you think about the idea that we see an animal that's struggling, a horse breaks a leg or whatever, and we put the horse down, we put the dog down, whatever. We don't think twice about that. But if you have a materialist worldview, perhaps you don't have to think twice about putting a human being out of its suffering, out of his or her suffering.
Yeah, certainly. And Jerry Coyne, in his book, I think it's called Fact Versus Faith, if I recall correctly. It might be Faith Versus Fact, but I think it's Fact Versus Faith. Jerry Coyne, who's a prominent atheist, he was a evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. He's now emeritus. But he, in his book, Fact Versus Faith, makes that very argument. He says, look, we put animals down. That's the compassionate thing to do. So why won't we do that for humans? And so my response to that is, well, Jerry, why don't we, round up all the homeless people in Chicago? He's from Chicago. Why don't we just round up all the homeless people there? And why don't we incarcerate them and sterilize them? And then if we can't find a home for them, we can't find anyone to take them into their home, then we will euthanize them. And Jerry Coyne, of course, progressive that he is, would be horrified by any kind of a suggestion like that. He would say, no, of course we're not going to do something like that. But what I just described to you is exactly what we do to dogs. And so the point is, we don't treat dogs the way we treat humans. We don't treat humans the way we treat dogs, and we shouldn't. And he knows that, but they will still use that argument. And he does use that argument in his book to say, well, we put down dogs. That's the compassionate thing to do. So we should do it to humans too. Well, my argument is, well, humans aren't dogs.
I was going to get into this a little later on in the podcast, but maybe I'll broach this subject right now. And this is asking for your opinion. Look, right now we have a huge debt, a debt that could cripple a country, destroy a country. We're talking about $35 trillion, somewhere in that vicinity. Where do we get to in America where we say, you know what? The homeless people you're just talking about, they're a burden to society. Or elderly people that have diseases that are going to lead to death anyway, they're a burden to society. Where do we get to a point where we say, look, we need to look at our debt, we need to look at the whole, the good of the people that are healthy and wealthy and wise, and get rid of these people, round up these people that you mentioned in your analogy, and get rid of them because they are costing us a lot of money. I mean, there's a societal factor here, but you can also look at families. As I mentioned, I grew up in the Netherlands where you start to think, you know what? If my uncle Pete or my aunt Gertrude, if she keeps living, whatever inheritance I would get will be gone. Maybe it's better for her to die. I think about this very thing. I mean, all of my siblings are Christian. The very thought of allowing my mother to die early because she had dementia would be anathema to us. But, you know, we looked at the reality that the longer she lived, the more we would have to chip in to take care of her financially. Now, we had no problem doing that whatsoever because we saw the value of her life. But if you're a secular society, I can, what's that agency we have now? DOES. Say, you know, look, this is a way that we can cut a lot of money out of our budget.
Oh, yeah, and that works itself out in several different ways. One way is that when Oregon, I mentioned earlier that Oregon, when they allow assisted suicide, they actually do take surveys of why the people have wanted assisted suicide. And one of the responses that is used, I think it's over 90%, if I recall correctly, of responses. And by the way, they can have multiple causes, so it's not like they can choose. They can have three or four or five different causes. It's not like they're choosing one. Over 90% of the respondents, if I recall correctly, had said that they do not want to be a burden on their relatives. That's one of the reasons why they're requesting assisted suicide. So sometimes this issue of being a burden on others, the person themselves has internalized that, and they don't want to be a burden on other people. And so they think it's better if I just go ahead and die now rather than, you know, burden my relatives either financially or with time and other kinds of things like that. So that's one way that issue can work itself out. There's another way, interestingly, that can work out though too. And that is by other people suggesting that you should go ahead and kill yourself with assisted suicide or euthanasia. This has happened. This is not just speculation. This is something that's actually happened on a number of occasions. Let me give you one example that I bring out in my book. A retired corporal in Canada. Canada has had euthanasia since the 20-teens, has really one of the most advanced euthanasia systems out there in terms of the numbers of people being killed. But in 2022, so just a couple of years ago, a lady named Christine Gauthier, who was a corporal in the Canadian military, but she became paraplegic. She actually competed in the Paralympics at one point. But she gave testimony to a parliamentary committee in Canada that she was having problems with the Veterans Affairs Canada because she was trying to get them to install a wheelchair ramp on her home. And they didn't want to do it because it was too much expense, right? So what you're talking about, you know, this issue of money, you know, they didn't want to fork out the finances to give her a wheelchair ramp at her home. And so she has to crawl out of her house, you know, to get into her wheelchair and such and to get anywhere. Well, in 2019, when she was asking for this wheelchair ramp, a Veterans Affairs case manager said this to her: "Madam, if you are really so desperate, we can give you medical assistance in dying now." You know, so here she's being told, you know, "Oh, we can't afford to give you this wheelchair ramp, but if you want medical assistance in dying, we can get that for you." You know, so here we have this situation where, okay, you know, we're not wanting to provide for you in a way that, you know, you can live comfortably, but we are willing to kill you and let you die if that's what, you know, if you're willing to write off on that. And that's not the only time this has happened. There's a man in Canada also who had like $100,000 in hospital bills, and the hospital personnel were telling him, you know, "You got to take medical assistance in dying, you know, because you're running up these huge bills. You're never going to be able to pay this, you know," and all this. And so this has happened on a number of occasions. The other way it works itself out too is that insurance companies, of course, benefit when people take assisted suicide. And so they, of course, are very willing to cover the costs of the prescription. They may not be willing to cover the costs of your procedure that you need, you know, to make your life bearable, but they will be willing to cover your assisted suicide dose that you could get. So there's a number of different ways that this works itself out in terms of sometimes pressuring people. You know, usually people aren't going to out and out, you know, say, "Hey, you know, you ought to kill yourself," you know, but although a few occasions that's happened, but usually that's not going to happen. But still, there's this subtle pressure that I think is more pervasive that people feel like, "Well, I just did better if I do it so that I'm not a burden on people in society." You know, it's interesting with your point, though, that you're making is, you know, when is it going to reach the tipping point where the society is going to be even more pushing for it? You know, I don't know. I hope it doesn't come to that, but, you know, it could. You never know.
Speak to the issue of cognitive dissonance, because on the one hand, there's a very strong sentiment towards equity or equality, not that the two are equal. On the other hand, a lot of people have imbibed Friedrich Nietzsche's idea that we're not created equal. We're not created in the first place, but we're not equal, and have really underscored a radical opposition to equality. I mean, we saw this in Nazi Germany, where you have on the one hand a predilection towards the Übermensch, the Superman, and the other, the disabled, or the person that is not of the right ethnic origin or whatever. And you can get rid of those. And that's all permissible in the struggle for survival, the struggle of the fittest.
Yeah, you're right. It is cognitive dissonance. And there's this interesting interplay going on where people are, you know, if you look at the higher echelons of intellectual life and such, where Nietzsche's ideas are being lauded and honored and such, even though he was teaching this radical inequality and such, where there's people are talking about social justice and other kinds of things, and all these trying to bring about equality for all sorts of ways. There is sort of a dissonance there, and it comes out in a number of different ways too in this particular issue as well. I mean, in terms of the dissonance, I mean, people with disabilities, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act that was put forward in the 1990s. And there's a lot of push for disability rights and such. And I should say too, that some of the people that are promoting rights don't even believe in rights, just like I mentioned earlier about Rari not believing in rights. There's also people that are embracing Nietzsche's philosophy, don't believe in rights. People, Foucault, who I don't know how familiar you are with Foucault, but Foucault is a famous French thinker in the late 20th century. He's considered a darling among a lot of intellectuals today in American academe. And Foucault taught that there was no such thing as human rights, even though he would use the language of human rights himself. He would use that language to try to, you know, it was basically a rhetorical move to try to convince people and get people on board with his projects that he was wanting, which, by the way, he also promoted assisted suicide. And I talk about him in my book, Death of Humanity. Foucault's ideas, which are again, very widespread, and they talk about there's no such thing as human rights, but then they'll use the language of human rights, you know, when it suits their purposes, and they think they can push their rhetorical moves. So there's this cognitive dissonance on all sorts of levels. It comes out with the disability rights as well, which I just mentioned. There's, you know, the push for disability rights. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people in disability rights groups that are now pushing against assisted suicide and euthanasia because they see the way that that's going and that that's going to put people with disabilities to take that line of attack. We also have the cognitive dissonance in relation to suicide. We have all these anti-suicide programs that are being very often funded by governments and such, and, you know, hotlines and everything else to try to dissuade people from committing suicide, unless, you know, you happen to have this particular condition, and that will help you, you know, commit suicide. And so, again, there's cognitive dissonance there, too. You know, what is it about that? Why is it that we're saying that this young person, you know, who this teenager, you know, or 20-something person who wants to commit suicide because they've been jilted by their lover or something like that, you know, or whatever, that they've been bullied by their peers. Why are we trying to offer suicide prevention programs for them? But then these other people, you know, will help them commit suicide, you know, if that's really what they want. So there's dissonance there as well that I think we need to reckon with.
As long as we're naming names, talk about the organizers or the members of the growing euthanasia movement in both the United States and places like Britain.
Well, there's a lot of bioethicists in the United States who are pushing it. I mentioned Peter Singer already as one who is sort of in the higher echelons of the bioethics movement. There's a lot of other bioethicists, though, who are promoting the ideas of euthanasia and assisted suicide. There's also sort of the organizers, though, who are more sort of the grassroots trying to push it in the different places in Oregon in the 1990s and then in the other states and trying to spread it to different places. So there's organizations used to be called the Euthanasia Society of America back in the 1930s and 40s. They've since morphed. They're not Compassion and Choices is one of the organizing figures of them. So they're trying to sort of organize it on a grassroots level and push it, put legislation in different places. They're not always successful. And again, we do have 10 states that have it. But interestingly, this past year, although it was introduced to a number of legislatures, fortunately, none of them adopted it except for one. And in that case, the governor, this was in New Jersey, the governor vetoed the bill. It barely passed. It passed, I think, by one vote, if I recall correctly, in the legislature. The governor, who Democratic governor, vetoed it. So this is actually a bipartisan issue. It's not just necessarily a partisan issue. It does seem that more on the Republican side are opposed to it and more on the Democratic side are supportive of it. But it's not just a Democratic-Republican thing. There's a lot of Democrats who oppose it as well. And not sometimes for ideological reasons, but sometimes also just for practical reasons that they recognize that, you know, once you get rid of human equality, you know, where do you draw the line? That's the big issue. And that's one issue that I raise in one of the last chapters of my book. I have a chapter on the slippery slope and a chapter on autonomy, those two arguments, the slippery slope argument is usually considered the best argument against assisted suicide and euthanasia. The autonomy argument is usually considered the best argument for euthanasia and assisted suicide. And so I try to dismantle that. But in the slippery slope argument, I talk about the way that once you decide that there is no, that human life, that some human lives don't have any value, where do you decide which ones those are? You know, who decides what human lives have value and which ones don't? And interestingly, Peter Singer, who has wrestled with that question, has said that they have, that human beings, in order to have value, and by the way, he, along with others, other bioethicists, use the term personhood theory, or call someone a person. They distinguish between a human being and a person, and they say a person has value, but a human being doesn't necessarily have value. They may or may not, depending on whether they're a person. But what defines a person? They say a person is defined by having a certain kind of rational capability, ability to, and Singer talks about them being able to plan the future, for example. But how much of that do you need? You know, that is really, you know, they don't really provide any clear idea as to how much rationality, how much ability to plan the future does it have to be there in order for a human being to be a person? And so there's no real clear dividing line even among them. And I actually pressed Peter Singer on that in the radio debate that I did with him by saying, well, I said, okay, you know, Joseph Fletcher, who was a famous bioethicist back in the 1950s and 60s, well, famous among bioethicists, not among the general populace, but Joseph Fletcher, who helped formulate this personhood theory back in the 50s and 60s, he claimed that there were 15 different characteristics, you know, that helped define a person. And it had to do things with like appreciative aesthetic values and morality and other kinds of having moral values and other, and as well as rationality and things like that. So there was a number of different things, 15 different things that he said. So I asked Peter Singer, now, you know, you're telling us rationality and the ability to plan the future is what gives a human being value. Fletcher gave these other characteristics and everything too. So, you know, how do we decide which one, which actually defines human being? And Singer really couldn't answer that. He basically said, that's a discussion we need to be having. That's what he said. He didn't really have an answer for that.
But it's a discussion he's already had with himself, because as I remember, if I remember correctly, you make this distinction between a human being and personhood. Singer doesn't want to say that when someone is birthed, that you immediately can say, now we have personhood, but it may take a period of time before we can make that decision. I remember the number 3 days. It seems arbitrary, but that's what I remember him saying. Is that correct?
One time he actually said 1 month, and other times he's actually given differences. But right now, and when we talked about it on the radio interview that I did with him just a few years ago, now he's unwilling to take a stance as to when the baby becomes a person. He clearly does not think that a baby is a person. A newborn baby, he does not think is a person. That is clear. But again, he's unwilling to say when. And interestingly, in my opinion, based on his own philosophy, there really isn't a dividing line based on time, because different babies might have different rational ability. Different babies might have different abilities in terms of planning the future, which is the two of the big things that he relies on there. So in reality, I think based on his own philosophy, different human beings would become persons at different times. There is no one time when they would, you know, become a person there. And also the end of a life, Singer believes that if a person loses their cognitive capacities, so if a person has dementia, for example, Singer also argues that they no longer have a value in their life, and thus their life can be terminated as well. So, but there's no real clear dividing line, and Singer is pretty cagey about trying to put a dividing line on it. He really doesn't have a way to do it. And that's the problem, in fact, not just with Singer's philosophy, but the philosophy of anyone that wants to try to say, well, let me give an example here in California. Okay, in California, which our law is actually based upon the Oregon law, so it's pretty similar to the Oregon assisted suicide law. Under the California assisted suicide law, you have to have a physician diagnose you. In fact, you have to have two physicians diagnose you with a terminal illness and you with which you have less than 6 months to live. Okay, so that's the dividing line that the California legislature has made and determined to allow assisted suicide or not allow assisted suicide. So, but why 6 months? You know, why not a year? And even, by the way, even with 6 months, it's very subjective because physicians don't know exactly how long a person can live. And so some people in Oregon who have the same law, 6 months, some people have lived longer than 6 months, some people have lived longer than a year with their medications that they've been given for assisted suicide, because you're not required to take them, of course. You're allowed to take them whenever you want to. Some people in Oregon never take their assisted suicide medications that are prescribed to them. And sometimes they live more than a year long, or something, who knows how long in some cases. So the idea is very simple. And why a terminal illness? And in fact, if you look at other countries like Canada and Belgium and Netherlands, they don't require a terminal illness. They only require that a person be in irremediable suffering, for example, or something like that. So once you get rid of the idea that every human being's life has value, there's no real clear dividing line of where to decide to draw that line. Who's going to have value and who's not going to have value? That's just a shift. It's going to be basically a shifting thing based on whatever values. So usually what happens in the United States when people are pushing for legalization of assisted suicide is they try to claim that, oh, we're just doing this for a very small number of people. It's just a very, you know, tiny minority that population who's in this intense suffering, you know, right at the end of their lives and such. If we look at other countries, but then what happens is once they get that law on the books, they tend to try to push for expanding it and broadening it. Now, in the United States, they haven't been particularly successful in broadening it a lot, although they have a little bit. In Oregon, for example, you used to have to be a citizen of Oregon. Now you don't have to be a citizen of Oregon. You can come from any state in the United States to Oregon to get assisted suicide. So they do have been broadening out in certain ways, although they still have the six-month law. But if you look at other countries like the Netherlands and Belgium, which have had assisted suicide and even euthanasia much longer than the United States has, and where the culture has adopted that to much greater extent, now we have situations where 4-5% and even more of the deaths in those countries are being done through euthanasia. Canada, I think, is all, if I recall correctly, is also where 5%. Now, the deaths in Canada are being caused by what they call medical assistance in dying, that is euthanasia.
That's just
so
staggering.
It starts expanding more and more. Yeah, so one out of every 20 deaths.
You know, you write about Holland, and justifiably so, or the Netherlands. I was born there, as I mentioned earlier on the podcast, and I, you know, I love the Netherlands. Every time I land in the Netherlands, I feel happy because it was the place I was born, and euphoria overtakes me. But if you look at Netherlands, you have a microcosm, maybe even a an idea of what's going to happen in other countries as they progress in their thinking, as they become more and more secularized. But here you have a land of the Reformation that is now secularized to the point that they are giving us a roadmap to what is happening or what can take place all around the world.
Yeah, and other countries are following suit. It's happening not rapidly, I would say, but Germany, Spain, and Austria in the past few years have allowed for assisted suicide.
Belgium.
As well. And Belgium. Well, Belgium went right along with Netherlands. They were pretty right behind.
Yeah.
So I spend a good bit of time in my book talking about Belgium. Luxembourg also, a much smaller country, but they also sort of went the same way that Netherlands and Belgium went. Luxembourg also. And Switzerland, of course, has gone a little slightly different route in the way they did it, but they are allowing it in a big way as well there. But Spain, Germany, and Austria just more recently have passed laws or had judicial decisions. In Germany, it was a judicial decision allowing for assisted suicide. And so, yeah, it's being followed by other countries as well. In Britain, the Labour government just took over and they just recently passed a bill. Now, it still has to be passed again, if I understand correctly. It's not a done deal yet. But it did pass the House of Commons to allow for assisted suicide in Britain as well there. So it remains to be seen if it's going to pass again and become law. It's not law yet in Britain, but it looked like it may be on the way. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, so the secularization of Dutch society, you actually, I don't know if you use the acronym or if I I tend to make up acronyms on the fly, but the secularization is epitomized by the secular revolution, by abortion, and by drug use. So you have a sad situation, the sexual revolution, abortion, and drug use. And you now see in Holland this progression that's taken place. You know, you've legalized drug use, you've legalized prostitution, all of this is sort of a prototype or a pattern for what is happening all over the world. And I need you to expand on that somewhat so that people can see, look, this has happened in a civilized country and it can happen here. This is not mythology.
Yeah, and if you look at the issues of relating to the fate of Christianity in the Netherlands as well, church attendance is much lower in the Netherlands than in most of the other European countries as well. So Christianity has really declined pretty considerably. You're right, it was country of the Reformation. It was Reformed Calvinist with the Dutch Reformed Church and everything. But yeah, it's really moved away from those roots pretty radically. I mean, the Enlightenment in the 18th century began a lot of that decline. And so even by the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, there already was a lot of secularization. Some of that got turned back. There were some revivals that took place in the early 19th century and such that turned back that to some degree, but still that secular mindset was going to begin to become stronger and stronger over time, over the 19th century. And then by the 20th century, by the time you get to the 60s with the sexual revolution, all that kind of stuff, it was going to become tidal wave.
On what basis is euthanasia determined? Who decides?
Well, in all the countries right now that have legalized euthanasia, it's supposed to be the person who is receiving it, that they're supposed to have the choice. And that's why philosophers argue for the autonomy argument, saying that the person should have the choice to be able to do these things. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that, though. For one thing, although the person is supposed to be the one choosing it, there's a lot of evidence that in countries that implement euthanasia, that the physicians do seem to have a little more license to do things that they end up getting away with in terms of killing people who may be not willing to do it. And willing is kind of a fudge term too in certain ways, because we had one case in, I think it was in Belgium, it might have been Netherlands, but I think it was in Belgium, where a woman had signed an advance directive that if she reached a certain cognitive state that she wanted to be euthanized. And when she reached the state where her family and physician thought she had, you know, reached the place where advance directive should kick in, they wanted to administer that to her. But interestingly, they asked her first, you know, whether she thought the time had come for her to be euthanized. And she said no. You know, she made very clear she did not want to be euthanized at that point. They went ahead and held her down and did it anyway, and euthanized her. And in court, they were exonerated, having done that. There was a court case over it. They were prosecuted, but they were exonerated by the court for doing that. So this lady, you know, at one point did ask for euthanasia. Later on, she says, no, I don't want it. And apparently she wasn't allowed to change her mind because she had dementia. And so they got to make the choice for her. There's also evidence that in countries with euthanasia protocol, that there do tend to be more abuses by physicians of people who do not have the ability to make the choice themselves. So what would be called non-voluntary euthanasia. So if a person's in a coma, if a person, you know, doesn't have the ability to make the choice, it seems like physicians are more frequently putting them to death than they would otherwise. And again, not just by withdrawing treatment. That's because the judicial system in the Netherlands, the judicial system has sort of led the way for the push for euthanasia. In the Netherlands in the 1980s and 90s, there was no law permitting euthanasia. It was still technically illegal. The courts allowed it, and they even not only allowed it, They actually drew up stipulations of here's what has to happen for this to be legal. And so really they were writing the law themselves, the courts were. And so a lot of this was driven by the judicial system. And so if the judicial system is not going to, you know, prosecute people, or if they're not going to, you know, convict people of these things, basically it allows it to happen.
Yeah, whether it's legal or illegal becomes irrelevant because there's no consequence.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. In the Netherlands, you can euthanize people for any and for every reason. Is that a fair statement?
Just about, as long as they're willing, as long as they are willing to sign off on it and say that they want to be euthanized. So people have been euthanized for eating disorders. People have been euthanized for mental illnesses of various sorts. People have been euthanized. I think this was in Belgium. It may not have been in the Netherlands, maybe in Belgium, but in either Belgium or the Netherlands, people have been euthanized who were in prison and who claimed that being imprisoned was a painful situation for them and they couldn't endure it. So here you have, you know, talk about cognitive dissonance. You have this situation where you have capital punishment has been banished by all European countries, or most, I should say, most European countries, certainly Western European countries. So you'd have no capital punishment because they consider that barbaric, but then they will euthanize someone who's in prison, who claims that their situation is too painful to deal with any longer. So you got people that have been euthanized for quite a variety of reasons. And in Canada, you have the situation where people have been euthanized who have been able to come up with an excuse of a particular ailment or illness, but the real reason is they were homeless or threatened with homelessness. That's happened. So, in fact, there was actually one case where a guy was asking for medical assistance in dying or euthanasia because he was afraid of going homeless. And he actually was eventually befriended by someone who was opposed to euthanasia, and he was actually convinced not to do it. And he wrote a book about it and everything. But there are people who have been, you know, threatened with homelessness who've said that that's why they want to get euthanasia. Usually they have to have some other kind of excuse. And if they have some other kind of ailment, they'll use that as their excuse to do it. But the real reason why that, again, you get euthanized because of loneliness. And again, you have to usually have some other kind of excuse to do it, but sometimes that's the reason.
Yeah. So I was going to get into this a little later, but I want to ask you now, autonomy. I mean, if you say someone can't do it, aren't you infringing on their autonomy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because the autonomy argument being one of the strongest arguments, according to philosophers, that's the strongest argument for assisted suicide and euthanasia. But what's interesting, well, a number of things interesting about that. Well, one is that why are they having physicians do it then? You know, why is it physician-assisted suicide? Obviously, there's someone else involved. It's not just the individual.
So it's not human
autonomy.
Autonomy,
the person, yeah, not, the person's not doing it themselves.
Yeah.
Now, with assisted suicide, you are writing a prescription and, you know, the person is taking the pills themselves. So in that sense, they're doing it themselves. But a physician has to write that prescription, and the physician gets to decide whether to do it or not. The physician doesn't, you know, the person who is asking for assisted suicide has to get permission from the physician. They have to get the prescription from them. They have to get the physician to sign off on it. So it's not really autonomy. Autonomy would be anyone could get it for any reason whatsoever. You know, a teenager who, you know, gets bullied by their classmates, you know, I guess if you'd say, let's say if they're 18, okay, so they're, at least they're not a minor or something, but, you know, if anyone over 18, let's say if they're, you know, they're getting bullied by their classmates or something like that, okay, you know, let them have it, you know, that autonomy would be with them decide. So it's not really autonomy where the physicians get to decide. Also, the laws are deciding too by telling you, you know, if you're, and by the way, laws always limit our autonomy. Think about it, the seatbelt law. Why do we have seatbelt laws? To protect us from ourselves, because we are prone not to do things sometimes that might be safe for us. So the government mandates that we do safety, certain kind of safety things. Well, you know, the government can legitimately mandate that we not kill ourselves too, as part of that. So, you know, we're not autonomous in that sense. The law always is infringing on our autonomy. And we're not a law to ourselves. Autonomy literally means being a law to yourself. Nomos is law, auto is self. So you're a self-law. But we're not self-laws. And also, the other issue with autonomy is the issue of pressure, both the law itself exerting pressure that wasn't there before. If there's no law for assisted suicide and euthanasia, then there not the temptation for it. Well, there could be the temptation for it to some degree, but not as big a temptation toward it. But also there's the social pressure of other people. We're not islands. We're, you know, we're not just here all by ourselves. We mentioned this earlier in the podcast too, where we're talking about the fact that, you know, there's people that are pressuring other people to get assisted suicide and euthanasia. Sometimes not overtly. Sometimes it is overt. Usually not overt. Usually it's more subtle and such. But you know, they feel pressured by other people, or they feel like, I feel like I'm being a burden to others. Well, that's not autonomy. If you're feeling like you're a burden to someone else, and that's why you're committing suicide, that's not autonomous. That means you're not just doing it because of your own self. You're doing it because of other people. And so there's a lot of problems with the autonomy argument because it just doesn't work.
Talk about the life and legacy of Jack Kevorkian. I think any discussion on euthanasia has to involve Dr. Death.
Yeah, Jack Kevorkian actually, in many ways, set back the euthanasia movement. Many of the people in the euthanasia movement were actually embarrassed by Kevorkian because he was so radical in his approach and so radical in his desire to promote death. And that's why he got the nickname Dr. Death, which he had actually been before he started his suicide thing. He was fascinated with death, and he was studying death. And even before, he was doing scientific research and things, medical research about death, before he even began his suicide machines that he did to put people to death. But then in the 1990s, when he began actually putting people to death, of course, it created a big splash. He got a lot of media attention for helping people commit suicide. And there were court cases, of course, over it. He was prosecuted. A couple of cases he was not convicted. But then finally, he went ahead and himself pushed the button where he was not just helping someone else commit suicide. He actually was doing it himself, which is euthanasia. And at that point, he was convicted. And also Michigan, where he was, also tightened up their laws in the 1990s. Also, they passed laws restricting, because there were a lot of laws where it wasn't illegal necessarily to help someone commit suicide. Not explicitly, that is. And so Michigan actually did pass an anti-assisted suicide law in the 1990s in relation to Kevorkian. And again, because of Kevorkian's a lot of the press he got tended to give people a very negative view of him and of euthanasia-assisted suicide. And so a lot of people in the assisted suicide movement tried to distance themselves from Kevorkian and his antics.
What is the state of bioethics in general?
Well, bioethics, like our academic and scholastic world and on the whole, does tend to tend to become more and more secular in its outlook, more accepting of ideas about abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, also transhumanism, also, which we haven't discussed here as well, the notions that we as humans need to sort of evolve ourselves up to a higher level, create ourselves into being something even higher than the humans are today. And by the way, that gets into those issues of equality that we were talking about earlier too, because the issues of, okay, what happens if we, you know, evolve ourselves to a higher level, you know, create a superhuman, you know, or again, they call it transhuman, you know, going beyond humanity. There's a lot of bioethics. In fact, there's the Julian Savulescu, who's the editor of the Journal of Biomedical Ethics. He's a big promoter of transhumanism and is also a supporter of abortion, infanticide, or at least I shouldn't say infanticide. I'm not sure if he supports that. I think he does, but I'm not positive. And euthanasia and such. So bioethics community is largely in support of these kinds of ideas. There are, of course, those within the bioethics community that are pushing back too. There are people that have Judeo-Christian values in the bioethics community, but they're a minority and they're sort of swinging against the stream.
Yeah, so the obvious question, would you call Oregon sort of the suicide tourism capital of the U.S.?
Well, interestingly, Oregon only, I think it was last year, if I recall correctly, maybe 2 years ago, but I think it was last year, Oregon opened up themselves to suicide tourism by striking down the requirement that you had to be a citizen. There was, of course, the spectacular case that the media glamorized of Brittany Maynard back in the middle 2010s, I forgot the exact year, but she was not allowed to go to Oregon commit suicide without establishing citizenship there first. So she did. She actually moved to Oregon long enough to establish residency in Oregon. Residency is the right word, not citizenship. But she established residency in Oregon so she could then kill herself. And the media just made her a glamorous, heroic figure and everything for doing that and everything. California at that time did not allow assisted suicide. She was from California. And Oregon, again, you had to establish residency. Well, now, just recently, Oregon has now opened it up to where non-residents can seek assisted suicide. So it remains to be seen. We don't know what the statistics are going to look like and how many people are actually going to go there to get assisted suicide, but it's now open that they can do that if they want to. I think there's also, I'm not positive this, but I think there's another state in the East that also allows assisted suicide for non-citizens. I don't want to name the state because I'm not 100% sure.
You started commenting on this earlier on in the podcast, but in the book, you offer three arguments to demonstrate the validity of the slippery slope argument, the slippery slope argument against assisted suicide. And I want you to go over each one of them because I think they're so important. Ideas of consequences and not understanding the consequences of ideas is dangerous. The first point is the denial of human equality.
Yeah, it's once, and we've talked about this extensively just a little bit ago, you
Yeah.
know, that once you deny human equality, you know, there's nowhere to go in terms of where do you draw the line for that. And so that's the big problem. But it's very clear that people who are pushing for euthanasia and assisted suicide are denying human equality because they're saying some people deserve protection. And again, we discussed this in relation to suicide, you know,
Peter Singer, too.
anti-suicide laws, you know, so, you know, anti-suicide laws, you know, we protect the people who are, and we try, you know, we put up these barriers on the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, so people can't throw themselves off the Golden Gate Bridge to commit suicide. We do all these different things. We spend lots of money, you know, to keep people from committing suicide. But then we say there are these other category of people who will actually help commit suicide. So we're denying human equality in that sense. We're saying these people are worthwhile and valuable, and these people are not. You know, these people will help dispense with them. So that's where the problem comes in. And once you do that, then it can open up to bigger and bigger categories too. Again, as we've seen in the Netherlands and Belgium and such, you've had it for the longest time. They do tend to be opening up to greater and greater categories. Canada also. Canada was originally supposed to allow people with mental illnesses to have medical assistance in dying or euthanasia earlier this year, but they actually postponed it. So fortunately, they're not allowing that yet just for mental illnesses. Although, again, even in the United States, we have situations where people with mental illnesses have of various sorts have been given assisted suicide. And again, sometimes it's because they expand the categories different ways. So let me give you an example here too about how that works out in terms of human equality. So in Colorado, a physician has prescribed assisted suicide pills to people with eating disorders. And the reason that this was legally permissible was because the physician argued that with their eating disorder, they would die within 6 months if they continued not eating, which was what they were not doing. And so they said they have it's a terminal illness, you know, an eating disorder is a terminal illness because if you don't eat, you're going to die. So this way, those people were then decided to be less valuable, really, than other people because we allow them to kill themselves and not others. So it opens up to people with mental illnesses, it opens up to people with physical disabilities, and the categories sort of widen as time goes on, it seems. And again, we see this happening historically too. And that went in terms of historically, you know, it's especially since the late 20th century, since the 1980s and 90s, we do see the categories expanding over time and becoming larger and larger. So once you deny human equality, you know, basically it's up to, you know, your own subjective opinion about, you know, where to draw the line of who is valuable and who is not.
Trudeau, is it fair to say that he is a champion, a cheerleader for euthanasia?
Oh yeah, he is. He did help investigate that situation that I talked about earlier, where that corporal had not received funding for her wheelchair ramp. He was kind of horrified by that particular issue. He doesn't want people to have to seek assisted suicide or euthanasia because of poverty or something like that. Although, again, that is happening in Canada with homelessness and poverty and that kinds of things. But he definitely is a champion of it in relation to people who are suffering with illnesses of various sorts. And again, and including mental illnesses. Although, again, they did postpone the mental illness thing, too. So the Trudeau's government did postpone that one as well. So it remains to be seen how far they're willing to go with it. But certainly he's been a big supporter of euthanasia.
Your point, too, vis-a-vis the slippery slope argument, the pressure to end one's life, your comments.
Yeah, in the slippery slope argument, I talk about the pressure of legalization itself. In the next chapter on autonomy, I talk about the pressure of social pressure of other people that we already talked about a little bit with autonomy. But actually just legalizing assisted suicide opens up the slippery slope, because before it was legalized, people didn't have that option. And so it opened up the possibilities for things that before weren't possible. And so in that sense, it sort of slides you down the slippery slope further toward greater, and again, greater categories of people being included in the legalization. And once you legalize it, and again, historically, this has worked itself out, even if logically, I think I say this in the book, if I recall correctly, logically, the slippery slope argument may not quite hold, because there are ways which you could say, okay, we're going to stop here. We're going to, draw the line here and we're not going to go any further. But historically, it doesn't work that way. Historically, once you open the door, it tends to open the door to more and more categories, because you don't have any clear reason of why you're going to stop there. Why are you going to stop at 6 months? Why are you going to stop at terminal illnesses? Why are you going to stop at those particular categories? There's no clear rational reason to give that is compelling. So that just opens it up. Then you can go further down. So once you legalize it, then that just opens the door to greater and greater categories being included over time. And again, we've seen that happen historically.
Yeah, and then the third point you make is the alteration of the role of physicians in healthcare. And I think this is an incredibly significant point to give a commentary on.
Yeah, this is very powerful, because again, we talked earlier about the Hippocratic Oath, which physicians used to have to swear. I don't think they do anymore. The Hippocratic Oath, they were supposed to uphold life. They were supposed to stand up for life and uphold the right to life. And what's happening now with the push for euthanasia-assisted suicide is physicians are being recruited to be the ones to end the life. And so it blurred the distinction between, okay, now I have this this person here who is in the hospital, and the physician comes in, and the person, whatever state they may be in, is the physician going to save their life, or are they going to kill them? It's like we're giving them a new kind of choice. It used to be obvious. It used to be, of course, you're going to save their life if you can. You do your best to save their life. Now it's not so clear cut anymore. Now the physician's role has been changed to where now sometimes they might be called upon to end the life. And there are some physicians who actually are glorying in that. There are some physicians who are making it their primary task to end life now too. That's actually happening in places. And to be sure, there are still a lot of physicians who refuse to go along with the euthanasia-assisted suicide things. You're not required in most places. Although, by the way, in Canada, there's a lot of pressure, and there are places that are being required, facilities that are being required offer euthanasia, including Catholic hospitals and things like that who oppose it. But in the United States, in the states, their physicians are not required to offer assisted suicide in Oregon and Washington and California, but they're allowed to. And one interesting case that I discuss in my book is the case of a physician who talked a woman out of getting assisted suicide because he didn't believe in it. And so there are still physicians who are out there trying to rescue people from assisted suicide and euthanasia. But again, it's by allowing them to do it, it blurs the distinction. And when you go to countries like, again, Netherlands and Belgium, Luxembourg, more and more physicians are becoming involved as time goes on. In fact, it's a majority of physicians now that are either involved or say they are willing to be involved. In the United States, my understanding, I think it's still a minority, even in Oregon, if I recall correctly. I'm not 100% sure on that one either, but I'm pretty sure it's still a minority of physicians, even in Oregon, who are willing to do assisted suicide, write prescriptions for it. But still, it alters that role where they have now this new dimension of, okay, do I save this life? Do I kill this person or allow them to take their own life? So what do I suggest to them? And, you know, what are you trying to suggest to them? You know, and so now it's, you know, well, let them decide, you know. And well, you know, that's not, physicians used to be trying to save their lives if that's possible to do.
Yeah, you know, we oftentimes use this cliche, last but not least, but I think it really applies to your book. The closing argument or the conclusion of your book is a chapter or section called Redefining Death with Dignity. Let me quote here, quote, "It is far better to offer people love and compassion than help in ending their lives." Another quote, "Let's choose to be courageous and compassionate as we help people choose life rather than death." Expand on that.
Yeah, it's, you know, and again, I'm experiencing this myself, you know, in dealing with my 91-year-old mother-in-law who, you know, requires a great deal of love and attention to help her in her times of dementia. But this is what God's called us to. You know, God has called us to love your neighbor as yourself. You know, how do you want to be treated? You know, that's how we're supposed to be treating other people. And so, you know, I believe this is there's a euthanasia protection coalition in Canada that is spearheaded, that uses the term compassion, you know, not compassion, not choice, I think is their moniker. Anyway, something like that. But the point is, we should be offering compassion to people. And in a lot of cases, again, it's not even just pain that these people are suffering. In fact, when I was just flipping through my book earlier today, I came across one of the things that I'd written there where a person who actually said outright, you know, "I could probably bear the suffering if I had people around me, you know, who were with me and, you know, who loved me and such." And so love and compassion can do an awful lot in terms of healing the real inner struggles that people are having, even as they're facing things. Because there's a lot of people, even who do end up going through with euthanasia and assisted suicide, who are conflicted. You know, same thing with abortion, by the way, too. But there's a lot of people that are conflicted over these things. And if someone would come along who would show them some love and compassion, they might be willing to go through that suffering. They might be able might be the right better word there, to go through that suffering with the help that they would receive then. And as we try to give to people then the not only the love, but also the hope of that God gives us as well, you know, this can go a long way toward getting people through, you know, their tribulations and trials and sufferings. Just like you mentioned with your dad, you know, who, you know, said that there's a purpose here, you know, God's going to use this, you know, for his own purposes. And so, you know, I believe, really believe that as we, you know, struggle with these issues, and again, they're not easy issues. You know, again, I'm dealing with with dementia, and they're not easy issues to deal with. Pain and suffering are real. You know, they're not just something to be, you know, oh, you know, get over it. That's not the right response. The right response is not just to say, well, just go, you know, just endure it, just get over it. Just no, the right response is we need to sort of try to suffer with them. And by the way, that's what the word compassion literally means. The word compassion literally means suffering with a person. And that's where we need to be going. We need to be suffering with people. And the Bible says that if someone is crying, you cry with them. You know, suffering, you suffer with them. If they're cheerful, you're cheerful with them. But, you know, so we need to be with people and showing them the love and compassion that God has shown to us.
I couldn't help but think about my sister Joby. She's 1 year older than I am. She's going on 4 years struggling with pancreatic cancer. And I would argue that she probably has had the most productive 4 years in her life while she's been going through this battle with pancreatic cancer. Through this battle, she's helped more people, including myself, to come to a true valuation of things in many areas of life. And so you see, I mean, on the one hand, you could say she's got a terminal illness. Very few people are going to survive pancreatic cancer. On the other hand, I mean, her life has been fruitful, abundant, abiding fruit during this period of life. And so I couldn't help but think about her when I was reading through your book and thinking about the value of this book. You have the unique gift of being a very, very clear communicator on a podcast like this, but also a very easy person to digest when you're writing. You write about complex subjects, but you take the cookies from the top shelf and bring them down to the bottom shelf so all of us can enjoy them. And I really am deeply grateful to you for writing this book. I think it's a very important subject, oftentimes overlooked, but this is a critical piece of the puzzle in any society.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I did have some help from some editors too, by the way.
Yeah, well, we all do in our writing, but I am deeply grateful, Richard, for this book. Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing, the book available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. All you have to do is check it out on the web at equip.org or stand with us shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth. Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, the web equip.org. Richard, thank you so much for your time on the podcast, for writing the book, for making a difference while there's yet time. We deeply appreciate you.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you too.
Deep, deep privilege and pleasure. And again, if you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast. So long for now.